This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Recovery Radio. My name's Steve Martorano, your host and guide. We're here on Saturdays. We're talking about the disease of addiction every week, and most importantly, the many avenues available for recovery. So we hope to have some time with us smack dab in the middle of this holiday weekend. We've got an interesting one for you today. If you're like a lot of us, you probably have come no closer to an intervention than reality television. We're here to find out how much reality is in that TV depiction of it, and we could do no better than our guest. Karen Reese is a internationally certified alcohol and drug counselor. She's got credentials in advanced relapse prevention programs, and she is a certified clinical interventionist, and she's going to give us the who, what, when, where, and how of interventions on this edition of Recovery Radio, sponsored, of course, by Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, about which we will have more later, because I know Karen does a lot of work with the folks at Retreat. Karen, thanks so much for joining us on Recovery Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. You know, I really look forward to this show when they told me someone with your background is going to be on, because I have on occasion watched that television program, and I like everything else on reality television, I'm sure it bears some reality, but maybe not all. So I'm grateful for your time today to clear all that up. Before we get started, though, in the meat and potatoes of this, tell us about your background.
Sure. Well, I came to this field the way many people do, through my own addiction and recovery. I was an artist through my early childhood, and I went to school on a full scholarship for my fine art. And unfortunately, while I was in college, I succumbed to my addiction, which had started probably when I was about 16. So when I was in college, I was much more interested in obtaining drugs, and I did that through selling drugs, and, you know, my life really went off course. And despite being awarded a full scholarship, which as a teen I had really no appreciation for, I decided to pursue my addiction. And so I went full steam ahead into that instead, unfortunately. And for the next 6 to 7 years, I was active and nearly died many times, as many addicts will tell you. Very few people come out of addiction without having life-harrowing or, you know, harrowing experiences and close-to-death experiences, unfortunately. However, I did manage to pull myself out. I knew I was not living the right lifestyle. I did a geographical to get out of Colorado, which is where I was living at the time, and I moved back to New York. There were some things that happened that helped me get into counseling, and those things were traumas. A lot of people have traumas in their life as a result of their addiction. Some people have traumas that were preceded their addiction, but I think trauma is a big component. So with that, I got into counseling, and I realized that I wanted to get clean and sober, and I realized that connection was the key. My therapist was pushing me to go to 12-step meetings for a long time, and I wouldn't go. And when I finally went, I realized that that was a key to my recovery, was the connection and the fellowship that I experienced in the rooms.
Before we go, Karen, what put you off about 12-step, for instance?
What put me off about it initially?
Yeah.
Fear, that I wouldn't fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the drugs were so appealing to me initially because it gave me a way to fit in, to feel comfortable in my own skin. So here I was showing up in the rooms of a 12-step meeting with no drugs in my system, and I was very afraid to walk through the door. Frankly, many times I didn't. I sat in the parking lot until I finally got through that door.
Yeah, I ask because for so many people who are on the outside of this problem still, And look at that avenue, 12 steps and the rooms, and feel this. It's almost a universal initial feeling. I don't belong here. This is not where I should be. I'm not like them. So that's why I ask. What got you to that point, though? Besides, was it some
person?
A lot
of encouragement. It was mostly being pushed by my therapist at the time, and then just agreeing to take that suggestion. You know, once I got through the doors, though, the greeting that I received was really remarkable, and I felt that I knew somewhere deep in my soul that's what I really wanted, was true connection. I wanted to be cared about. And that's exactly how I felt when I walked into the room. I felt cared about.
So your substance abuse, if I understood your story correctly, occurred relatively late. I mean, it became out of control when you were in
very very rapidly.
and when you were in college, right?
It started before college, around age 16.
Okay.
And then I went, you know, and I lived the lifestyle, so to speak, after college. I didn't stay in college for more than a year.
And so your sobriety has led you to a career in treating the disease of addiction, and you have a wide background in various yes. Disciplines here. But you know, we are going to talk about this one specialty of intervention and being an interventionist. Before I ask you about working with families in this regard, were you ever the subject of an intervention?
I wasn't, and that's a great question, because one of the a young lady that I was intervening on one day, who walked out of the intervention and was sitting in the yard smoking a cigarette at her family home, I went out to check on her during the process, and she looked up at me and she said, did anyone ever do this to you? Did anyone, you know, intervene on you? And I looked down at her and I said, you know, no, but I wish they had. I did not have an intervention, but I stayed hidden in my addiction and away from my family. They really weren't aware of what was going on with me.
Well, here's where we get to the sort of, you know, the substance of this and why intervention is an interesting aspect of treating substance abuse. We know that this disease affects the entire family. And we also know that the family ought to be intimately or significantly involved in the addict's treatment as well.
Right.
That is never more apparent than when we talk about an intervention, because you know, this is a different beast than dropping somebody off at a facility and, you know, and helping them through that. The family is in the room. Tell us about the significance of that and working with families in the context of interventions.
Sure. So, you know, as you said, there's many people are affected by an individual's addiction, and most addicts are connected with their families, albeit in very unhealthy ways. The family is often spinning out of control themselves, trying to control something they have no control over. And that's, you know, something they need to learn. They're not going to control the addiction. That the addict needs help, and they need professional help. And all the best efforts of the family have not worked, usually because they're uninformed and uneducated about what works. So most family members, you know, will confront an addicted individual one-on-one. They'll argue, they'll plead, they'll bribe. They'll go to all lengths to try to help their loved one, so to speak, see the light, see that they're self-destructing, and it doesn't work.
You know, the other interesting, fascinating aspect of this is that while it's certainly true that the substance abuser, the person with the disease of addiction, needs to work on their recovery, you know, on an utterly personal level. They need to do it. No one ever sets up their own intervention.
No, it usually comes from a jumble of personal tragedies and crises.
Do families
eventually land somebody in a treatment center, if at all?
Mm-hmm. Do families usually arrive at the notion of an intervention late in the process? As you mentioned, they do a lot of things before that seem to be intervening, but the idea of an intervention probably occurs late in the process. Is that generally the case?
Absolutely. The family that will call me is usually at their wit's end, and it's because everything else has failed.
And so this is this is very often, as you say, their last resort. If this doesn't work, they don't know what they're going to do. How does that make it? Do you have to set them up for the eventuality that it might not work? You know, I mean, they're desperate. They think this is the final chance. How do you react to that as the professional in the room? What do you tell them to expect?
Well, I validate first of all, their feelings, their fears. Their fears, which are so intense, some of them don't believe it's going to work, but they'll come along in the process grudgingly because they don't know what else to do. And what I try to do is instill hope. In other words, there are no magic pills and there are no magic cures, but this is the best chance when we organize an intervention. It's taking a trajectory which is really heading in the wrong direction, and we're going to intervene and try to raise that bottom. So by educating the family as to why that's important to do, rather than allow the next crisis to occur, they'll usually get on board when they realize working together, getting on the same page, can really make a difference. They start to feel a little more hopeful.
And a little more empowered. You said raise the bottom.
Correct.
Explain that.
Raise the bottom?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, you know, people who are in the field understand, and addicts themselves understand, that addiction left uninterrupted will lead to devastating consequences, absolutely devastating consequences, up to and including death, of course, jails and institutions. So what we want to do is to prevent that bottom. There's a myth in the field that an addict has to hit bottom before they're willing to change. And we know that's not true from working with people in the field who have been mandated sometimes by the courts. You know, that's just an example. And the person may not want to be in treatment, and they may not have hit what they would consider to be their personal bottom. But once we have them in a treatment setting, then the professionals can go to work to engage that individual and try to break through the denial and get them to change their lives before they have a worsening crisis.
Karen Reese is our guest. Karen is, among many other things, a certified clinical interventionist. She has decades in the field of treating substance abuse, and she's here to give us the skinny on interventions. You're listening to Recovery Radio. Please don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano is my name. We're here every Saturday. We're talking about the disease of addiction, and it's all sponsored by Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. One of the people from outside Retreat that very often does work with them, and they refer back and forth to one another, is our guest on the telephone. Karen Reese is a certified alcohol and drug counselor. She's an advanced certified relapse prevention specialist, and she joins us in particular today as a certified clinical interventionist. Karen's here to tell us all about interventions and how they work. Karen, I said at the beginning of the show that most of us know interventions from that reality television show. So is that what a real intervention looks like?
Well, there's some reality to that. I'm afraid there's other aspects of the show which are a bit exploitative.
Oh, but, yeah. Indeed.
Yeah. But yes, in a sense it is. You know, an intervention is what is considered a well-planned, carefully structured process. And it's led by a professional when it's done properly, in my opinion. You need a professional there to lead it. So with that process, family members and concerned others join together to lovingly but firmly confront the addicted individual with their illness and the necessity for treatment.
Do people try to sort of DIY this thing? Do they really try to do interventions by themselves?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there are families who do that.
Tell us why it's important to have structure in this thing, and what does that structure look like?
Well, there's much structure to it. What we really want to do is organize that family system in advance so that everyone is on the same page. If people are uncomfortable with the process, or there are people in the family who would otherwise sabotage the process, we want to know and we want to eliminate those folks from the intervention. So a professional like myself can assess that when I meet with the family in advance.
Cool.
So really get a sense of who the players are.
All right.
And really give permission for people who are uncomfortable with the process to not participate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there's a lot of preliminary work that goes on before the actual confrontation. When you talk about people resistant to it, Are they automatically excluded from the process or?
No.
Okay, tell us why
they're
not.
Only excluded, they'll be excluded for two reasons. One, they don't want to participate. And two, they cannot come along with the program, meaning they're too angry and they'll be honest about it that they can't come from a loving place. We have to come from a loving place and treat the addicted individual with dignity and respect. And if not, if an individual in the family cannot do that, I expect them to tell me that in advance. We'll talk about that, and we'll ask them not to participate.
You know, again, as I've seen these things on television, the two mm-hmm. predominant moods seem to be anger and grief, a deep grief and sadness. How do you manage to make those two emotions, which can be counterproductive, work in the context of convincing somebody, you know, they should get help?
Sure. Well, we provide a letter writing structure to each family member in order to organize their thoughts, because of course there's anger there, and of course there's tremendous fear and grief. And we process those feelings in advance, and we validate those feelings because they're very valid. However, in order to make the intervention effective, we want to have people organize their thoughts and come from a loving place. So they need to find their compassion, find the love. They know they miss their addicted loved one. They miss the person they were before they were hijacked by the addiction. So I work with them to find that spot in their heart, the truth in their heart about their love for the person who's suffering, and come from that place. And I give them a letter structure.
And the letter isn't just an expression of how they feel about the situation?
Well, it's very specific. They go into exactly what they love about that individual and what they miss about the individual that we're intervening on. And then they go into specifically how they've been impacted by the addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So they get to say how hurt they've been, or how angry they just don't shout and yell about it, but they can speak about it.
Right. This isn't a list of the grievances and the offenses that they've suffered. This is what's happened and how it's affected them.
Yes, they get to say how they've been impacted. Absolutely. We listen for shaming. We don't want shaming or blaming going on. So they keep it in the eye.
Right. Is it important for the person with the substance abuse problem to understand that their actions have had these consequences? I mean, they must have seen the consequences of their action before the intervention. Why would the intervention impress them more?
Why would the intervention impress them?
Yes, when they hear the price that their family's paid.
Because they're very cut off prior to that. They're often very cut off from the shame and guilt that they feel. They feel tremendous shame, guilt, and remorse, and they keep using their substance of choice in order to block those feelings and cover those feelings. During the intervention, we really try to make sure that the individual is not intoxicated on anything so that they can hear that the impact. And yes, it can be very painful for them, but they need to hear it.
Yeah. What do you do when somebody shows up and they are high or inebriated? What do you do then? Do you call it off?
We plan an intervention around a time when the person is going to be the most sober they're going to be, usually first thing in the morning.
Mm-hmm. We're going to pick this up with Karen straight ahead. It's fascinating. Before we take the break here, Karen, it seems obvious to me, but I want to hear it from you. How therapeutic is this whole intervention process for the family?
Mm-hmm. Are you asking me now?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, yes. It's very therapeutic because the family has come together for a common purpose, and they've shared information with each other that they may not have previously shared. So the truth really comes out. The addiction has often been living in the shadows, lots of secretiveness. There haven't been good communication amongst family. So this is an opportunity for family to hear from each other, to share their experiences, to get on the same page for a common purpose, and ultimately to express how they've been impacted by the addiction.
Karen Reese, I'm sorry.
Karen, so that in and of itself is very therapeutic and empowering for them.
Great. Karen Reese, our guest. So we're talking about interventions, their role in recovery. This is Recovery Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. I remind you that it's sponsored by Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. Listen, if you need to make phone calls or you need to go online and check out people's reputations, you will discover in short order that Retreat, they're among the leaders in their field. And they sponsor the program. So, you know, we make no bones about that. But every week I give you their phone number in the same spirit. If Retreat can't help you with their world-class services and facilities and treatment, they'll help you figure out what it is you need. So it's purely an informational number we're giving you, 855-859-8808. That's the phone number, 855-859-8808. Please feel free to use that for any questions you may have about anything you've heard on this program or any questions in general about the disease of addiction. Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Center is 855-859-8808. Our guest on phone is Karen Reese. Karen is a certified clinical interventionist, and she's joined us to talk us about this aspect of treatment. And we're going to find a little bit later on how intervention, like so many other events in the treatment of this disease, is part of a bigger process. But Karen, I want to get sort of now into the nitty-gritty of how these things look. Let's begin with how one of these things is set up. I suppose it starts with a phone call from a family member. Is that the way it usually starts?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And the person who gives me that first call is the person that is my point person. They're the ones who are going to determine who will be invited to the intervention for that first meeting, I should say, because we have a couple of meetings that we have prior to the actual intervention. So the individual who calls is usually the person who's motivated to make it happen.
And when you say this, it's really strange. I hate to use this awful analogy, and I don't mean to minimize it, but it sounds like the kind of work that goes on when planning a surprise party.
Yes, I suppose it can have that aspect to it.
So that yes. That first person is identified by you as obviously, you know, your go-to person. They come. Yes. They come to see you, and they give you a list of these are the people I would like to invite. And what are you looking for in that list? What sort of red flags, or you know, what are you looking for?
Well, I'm looking for specifically folks that the addicted individual really loves and respects. So it may be people outside the immediate family as well. It could be friends. You know, it could be clergy, it could be a boss, it could be a teacher. Anybody that individual really loves and respects would be a valuable member of the intervention team.
What about siblings? What?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, but I mean, with regard to their role in this, are they, I don't want to say more helpful than others, but because I know that...
Yes, my experience is that siblings are a little less enabling than parents, and they tend to be a little bit angrier, and they tend to have a little more information. So they're a very valuable member of the team.
Expand on that for me, because that's my experience with interviewing a lot of people in these situations, that siblings are tougher on each other in general. But even in the context of this disease... You say they are less enabling. That's another way of putting it, right?
Well, like I find that the siblings tend to be a little bit angrier and less enabling than the parents. They're often carrying a lot of resentment that the addicted sibling has been sucking all the energy, all the family's energy and resources away from them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they also tend to be a little more aware of the substance abuse.
Right.
And the parents tend to be in a little more denial about it.
You see, you know, as you know, family dynamics are fascinating all by themselves, and this disease seems to only magnify other sort of garden variety family dynamics. You know, mommy loved you more than she loved me, or you get all the attention. The other thing I suspect is true about siblings in this context is that siblings feel less guilt about or responsibility for it. Mom and dad are going to beat themselves up forever saying, what did I do wrong? And siblings just go, I didn't do anything wrong. You screwed up. Is that pretty much the way it goes?
Yeah, I would say the parents carry more guilt, yes.
Absolutely. In a sense, that puts a sibling in a better position to be really objective about what's going on, right?
Yes. Yes. They're absolutely valuable members of the team. Very valuable. Those bonds are very strong, sibling bonds.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess siblings have a greater difficulty manipulating one another, right? I mean, the person with the disease of addiction can maybe manipulate mom and dad, but not her sister or her brother.
Right, less so. And, you know, what often happens is there's a lot of distance that's created between the siblings. So when the siblings come back into the picture for the intervention, that can be very powerful.
The other aspect of organizing this thing and setting up an intervention, who figures out who it is among the group that will get the person in the room?
So when I meet with the family, during the first meeting, I'm going to explain the process and all the options for the intervention. We're going to explore resources for rehabilitation, and I'm going to give and explain the letter writing structure. The whole purpose of these meetings is strategizing. It's all strategy. So I just throw it out to the family. So how are we going to get this individual to a meeting? You know, and they're the ones who know the schedule or the routine of the addicted, loved one, and they're going to come up with an idea of how we're going to get them into a particular location at a particular time.
Is it always necessary to, there's no other way to put it, lie to the person?
Well, no. It depends on the model of intervention you're using.
There are models where you tell them up front, we're setting up an intervention and we want you there?
Yes.
I was always under the impression these were always sprung on someone.
No, there's a model that is known as the invitational model. And in that model, we invite the addicted loved one to the very first family meeting. I just call them family meetings.
Rather than
a little less threatening.
Right. And so the person with the disease is informed about what's going on, and are they informed as to what to expect, that they are going to be
the family's getting together, right? Because they have some real serious concerns, and we'd like you to be part of that conversation because we're going to be talking about you.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they usually want to be part of that conversation.
How do you know ahead of time which model would work? Yeah.
Uh-huh. By meeting with the family or talking with the family, I give them these options, and they usually let me know what they think is best. They intuitively know what's the best approach. And sometimes things just evolve. In other words, I'll be coming to meet with the family, and unexpectedly the addicted individual will be there. And so we just invite them to be part of the process right from the start.
Yeah, this may seem obvious, but it probably isn't. What is the immediate goal that you set up? I mean, is it to, at the end of this intervention or this meeting, have the person leave directly for treatment? What is the ultimate goal of the intervention?
Most often, that's it. Because as you asked earlier, by the time the family member's reaching out to me, the disease has progressed quite a bit, and that individual is usually in need of an inpatient type of, residential type rehabilitation. So, yes, we prepare, make sure we have a bed available in advance for the appropriate level of care.
And the other question I have, which just left my head here now. I want to take a moment here. What are some of the things that people are confused about regarding interventions? I mean, what are the myths associated with an intervention?
Well, there are many myths. I think we touched on one before, that an addict has to hit bottom before they'll get help. Which I think we talked about is not true.
Mm-hmm.
If we can get an individual into a place where we can talk with them and engage them in the treatment process, they can turn their lives around. So that's one myth that's important to dispel.
And the other one that we just touched upon, which I'm surprised, it doesn't always have to be an ambush.
Correct. It does not always have to be that type of approach.
But I
do want to say, though, that even that is a myth, that it intervention is an ambush, even if it is a surprise. I mean, I guess one can look at it that way. But what's really important is that we take a very loving approach, so that even if the addicted individual is surprised by the family meeting that they're brought into, the love that's expressed in that meeting quickly overcomes any feelings that they're being attacked.
It is
not an attack.
Yeah, that first couple of minutes when the person walks in the room and is surprised to see family members there is a critical component there. Have you had occasions where people just turned around and walked out?
No, I haven't. I think they're usually stunned, or they know immediately what's happening. And because I'm there as a professional, but I'm a stranger to them, I usually extend my hand, shake their hand, ask them to please have a seat. We're having a family meeting, and would they just be willing to listen? They usually do.
Karen, we're going to take another break here, but before we do, you just touched upon your role, the role of the interventionist in the room. You're sort of guiding this meeting. Are you also kind of refereeing it and making sure it stays on point?
Yes, it's very much orchestrated and conducted by myself, if I'm the interventionist, working with the family. So, yes, there's many aspects of orchestrating this intervention, including the letter, in the letter writing process, what is the order of the letters, how they will be read, and the seating arrangements in the room, who's going to sit next to the addicted individual, who's going to sit across from that person. There are many aspects that we set up.
Karen Reese is on the phone with us. She is a certified clinical interventionist, and she has more for us straight ahead. Don't go away. This is Recovery Radio. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. I want to thank Karen Reese. She's been terrific on this issue of interventions and their role in treating the disease of addiction. Karen is a certified clinical interventionist, and during the break here, she was telling me that there's just many. She has done this many, many times, and have seen a wide variety of this people's behavior in the context of an intervention. And Karen, I want to get into the final segment here and talk a little bit, about why we do interventions and what we can expect from them. But I was fascinated by your comment just a little bit ago, where you said, in your experience, and it's pretty broad, people don't bolt from the room. I would have thought, 50% of the people go, no, I don't want anything to do with this. They don't do that in your experience, right?
Not initially. And I think it's because there's myself, a stranger, they tend to want to be on their best behavior. I think perhaps if it was just the family intervening, they might bolt. But because I'm a stranger, I'm introducing myself, I'm shaking their hand, I'm asking them to have a seat, they tend to do that. Now, we do, again, I talk about strategizing for all possibilities. There have been times where they'll get up and walk out of the room. It's usually not their initial reaction, but we plan for that. So we have a contingency plan for who's going to follow them if they walk out of the room and bring them back.
Mm-hmm. Have you had the occasion to do interventions for people who have been in and out of treatment? I mean, can an intervention work at any point in this process?
Absolutely. It's never too early and it's never too late. When you're trying to save somebody's life.
Yeah. So someone who has a family member struggling with this disease, who's perhaps relapsed and been in and out of treatment, ought not to just give up on interventions.
Well, right. And they probably haven't used intervention before, and it's a wonderful tool. Because when you talk about relapse prevention, we can engage the family in that process post-treatment. So I work with the family throughout the treatment process and post-treatment if they're available.
Mm-hmm. Are interventions helpful with regard to avoiding a relapse? And what I mean by that is, have you had the occasion where families would say, I'm worried about my son or daughter, they look a little shaky, and maybe we should have a little intervention? Does that happen?
Sure. Yes, to try to prevent backsliding, if the family wants to continue to work with me and consult, I'm going to work with the family to approach that the whole situation in the best way possible to get that person turned around before they, you know, if they enter into a relapse process. We know it's a process. So we want to get them turned around, back on track as soon as possible. And the family can be very helpful in that.
How do people find folks like you? I mean, you work with people like Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. You don't work for them. Some facilities have their own interventionist programs built into their treatment model.
Not many that I'm aware of, but for myself, I visit programs all over the country, and I learn about their programs, so I know where I want to refer. And a lot of my interventions are word of mouth, so people find me on various, you know, media sources, that type of thing.
Oh, so the final role is that as you guide people through this process, help them structure it, and then preside over it. You've got to be in a position to help them figure out what comes next, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Finally, let's talk about this notion of why we do interventions and dispel maybe this last myth that an intervention is going to cure something or solve something. It's part of a process. Talk about that for a moment, will you?
Sure. So the intervention is really designed to reach the addicted individual at their core and get them to say, yes, I recognize that I need help. So that is certainly the goal. However, we can measure success in several ways. As I mentioned before, the family coming together for a common purpose is a very validating and empowering experience for them. They finally get to speak the truth of how they've been impacted by the addiction. The addicted individual gets to hear how loved they are by their family, whether they accept treatment or not. They get to hear how their substance abuse has impacted the family. And they can't, you know, after an intervention, it's like you can't forget it because it's a very intense experience. And the family will learn how to support recovery and stop enabling addiction. So even if the addicted individual doesn't immediately say yes to treatment, I'll continue to work with the family to put the consequences in place that they have expressed will be put in place, okay, as a result of saying no to treatment. Mm. And usually, if the family stays on track, the addicted individual will agree to treatment within 2 weeks.
Karen, thanks so much. I hope we can have you back again. I know you have expertise in a broader arena than just interventions, but this has been very, very helpful. I think it's the first program we've devoted to the intervention model and how it works. So we appreciate your time and your expertise.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
That's it for Recovery Radio this week. Enjoy the rest of the last holiday of the summer, and look for us going forward in the fall. This is Recovery Radio. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.